This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conqueror's Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Africa is a land with endless stories to tell. From epic battles, brilliant rulers, and the dramatic rise and fall of civilizations, join us on the History of Africa podcast to learn the oft-ignored stories of the African continent. From the sands of Cairo to the plains of Zimbabwe, and from the mountains of Ethiopia to the forests of the Congo, find the History of Africa podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everybody. This is Trevor from the future, welcoming you to America Secret Wars, your podcast about all of the times the United States used military force that have been forgotten, buried, and covered up. This is part two of our episode on the Trieste Crisis of 1946, so go listen to part one if you haven't already. And if you're ready to listen now, join me with Roberto and Brendan from the History of Sockartvelo, Georgia and Tsar Power podcasts. We left off in the midst of the Trieste crisis after a pair of American cargo planes had been shot out of the sky by Yugoslavia, and the city of Trieste itself was full to the brim of tension and fears of another world war just after the second one had ended. The escalation with Yugoslavia in Trieste really felt like it could be the tipping point at the time, especially because the first C-47 was carrying a Turkish military attaché who was actually injured when the Yugoslav fighters opened fire. Now, we reach the point where I feel like it's valuable to present information in the same order that I discovered it. All of this about the C-47 attacks is pretty universal in any article you find on Trieste in 1946 or even the Black Sea Crisis, especially because it's listed on these same congressional reports that I use as a starting point for new episodes. However, I found the book Flashpoint Trieste near the end of my research for this episode, and Christian Jennings includes some very interesting details that are not included in the vast majority of other sources I found. Let's see if those details change your impression of the events. Though it was never admitted at the time, declassified flight planning documents and mission reports reveal that the United States had been launching a deliberate campaign of provocative flight paths since March of that year, with U.S. military planes, both armed and unarmed, intentionally skirting Yugoslavia's borders as they shuttled supplies and personnel for the rebuilding efforts in Austria. In just 1 month, the U.S. chartered 223 of these border-skirting flights, and carried out 32 of these missions in just 1 week of April. That same week saw a responding increase in Yugoslav troops in the occupation zone, and the British and American governors on the other side immediately threatened war if those troops approached the border.
Wow.
So that kind of makes it seem more predictable, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It really does.
The whole time I was like, so why are the Yugoslavs doing this? Like, I don't get it. And now I get it.
Yeah, because we had been deliberately testing their airspace for months.
That would piss people off, don't you think?
I love American history.
And the thing is, this is kind of the beginning of the era of constant military air power. Like, that had debuted in World War I, but like it wasn't really a factor during the interwar period. There weren't established rules for how to handle this sort of thing.
I'm guessing there were rules after this.
Oh, yeah. 3, possibly 4 direct attacks on the American occupation forces and a Turkish representative would have been a valid cause for war. And since Tito had made Yugoslavia communist, that meant they were lumped in with the Soviet sphere, which would reignite world war less than a year after the last one had finished up. The first Yugoslav attack had provided a justification for Truman to order a destroyer group into the Mediterranean, and in response to the second attack and the Vergarola explosion, he deployed 10,000 additional ground troops and anti-air defenses along the Morgan Line, as well as 30,000 to the Yugoslav borders with Austria and Italy. Most importantly, you have to remember, this is still in the middle of the terrifying few years worldwide when the United States was effectively God. In 1945, we revealed to the world that American scientists had learned to split and weaponize the atom, creating bombs that could blast whole cities to dust and firestorms within seconds. This idea had been kicking around since scientists first discovered radiation in the early 20th century, and the idea of a nuclear bomb was actively being researched by scientists in many countries throughout the 1930s. The Soviets had infiltrated the Manhattan Project early on and even been caught in the act in 1943. They even managed to steal the blueprints for the Fat Man nuclear bomb used on Nagasaki. But the USSR hadn't put their resources into that project during the war. America was the unitary nuclear superpower from 1945 until the first Soviet test in 1949.
Yeah, I just wanted to recommend a book to the readers. If you're interested in the history of Soviet espionage, I recommend the book Reds by Ted Morgan. On the cover, it says A History of McCarthyism. It's not good for that. It's more like a history of Soviet espionage. And then halfway through, it turns into a biography of McCarthy himself. But if the detail about the Soviets infiltrating the Manhattan Project interests you, an interesting note is that that was done through Communist Party members who were on the Manhattan Project. And they had done this under the noses of both Oppenheimer and the vast majority of Communist Party members at the time. This was the case of most Soviet espionage that party members had conducted prior to 1950.
Ah, CPUSA, how far you have fallen.
Yep.
I mean, if you don't have Soviet money like backing you,
no, and this is a reminder for all modern communists. The Soviet Union no longer exists, and Russia is not a communist state.
It is a fascist state.
What?
Yeah, you don't have to support them, it turns out,
yeah.
Even if you're a leftist.
Nani?
It's like an oligarchy led by an open fascist with ties to the Eurasian movement isn't a glowing standard of equality in the world.
Yeah, I should also point out that the Kremlin, not Putin himself, but a guy under Putin, has been documented reaching out to fascist movements in Italy, Greece, Germany, I believe. I think the Netherlands also. Don't quote me on that. But definitely, absolutely Italy and Greece. They were trying to build connections there in the early to mid-2010s, and probably still are.
Well, that's all right, then. They didn't say anything about denazifying those countries.
Very true. For fuck's sake. I mean, they weren't Nazis, they were just other kinds of fascists.
Yeah,
anyway,
boy.
What was I saying? Oh yeah, Roberto. But actually, no, never mind, it's not relevant. I was doing my Nani bit, and I wanted to know what is in Russian.
Store? Store?
No, import your bits, because that is good for cross-cultural podcasting. I don't know.
Very true. Yeah. I mean, you didn't bring us in on a Russia episode. This is kind of a Russia episode, because
I'm a Yugoslavia stan, so like I'm in for
yeah,
it.
We have a resident Titoist in here.
Yeah, I'm gonna raise some questions about that in a minute.
I'm kidding.
Yeah. Just because I'm a Titoist doesn't mean you should ask me questions about the big hole I'm digging in my backyard. Don't ask what it's for.
Oh, there's a big hole coming up, weirdly enough. Yeah. Anyway.
In what? Or whom?
For people who had been on those planes.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. The United States was the sole nuclear power, and we made sure that everyone fucking knew it. Even Churchill expressed anxiety over this in his Iron Curtain speech, being very cautious about the fact that one country wielding that much unopposable power, and he basically said, well, I'm glad you're on our side, but what the fuck are you doing?
Hearing that from a Brit makes me kind of annoyed.
From Churchill!
Churchill can go screw himself. I hate the man so much.
Yeah.
He's not even that great of a historian either.
No, he's a terrible historian.
Yeah.
He's just a compelling writer.
If that. He kind of sucks at that, too.
Look, the bar was lower in 1945.
I'm glad he lost that election.
Yeah, he was a good historian in comparison to what, Herodotus?
Yeah.
You know, Herod, I had a dream, let me tell you how it happened.
Atus. Like, probably on par with Plutarch.
Well, Herodotus would just say, hey, I heard this from these people here. So, but I'm going to give you different versions of it, because this is what I've heard. So at least he'd tell you his sources, somewhat.
Yeah. Remember, everyone, Churchill's the guy who wrote a counterfactual about what if the Union won the American Civil War, set in an alternate reality where the Confederacy won the Civil War. So there's that. He also almost started World War III during his second term as Prime Minister.
Of course.
And is the reason that the United States couped Prime Minister Mossadegh in Iran. So that's fun.
Oh, yeah. They did do that.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That'll be an episode someday.
It's kind of hard to keep track of all of the American coups, hence the necessity of this podcast.
They're like their own whole subgenre. Anyway, the public on both sides of the Iron Curtain genuinely thought the United States was about to nuke Yugoslavia before opening full-scale war against world communism, but this time with super weapons. This was heightened even further by the establishment of U.S. Strategic Air Command in Dahran, Turkey, which signaled that American air power was positioned to be within range of the USSR at all times.
It's so weird, like, the use of the term super weapons, I normally associate that with a positive. It's like the Great War. Well, war is not great to begin with. It sucks.
Yeah.
Weapons aren't good. Why would you call them super?
Because they are superior to other weapons.
Very big weapons is a better term, in my opinion.
Great weapons. I think we should go back to the Greek and Latin style of just using great for everything that's big or large or important.
Boomius Maximus?
Yes.
Shootius
there we
Maximus.
Go. New name for nukes. Boomius Maximus.
Boomius Maximus! Boom! But it has the little water drop sound every time you boosh. Boop.
Well,
massive mushroom cloud. Water drop sound.
The Soviets countered the threat of Boomius Maximus by deploying troops within striking distance of Turkey's borders in Bulgaria and the Caucasus Republics. And frankly, if this were happening 2 or 3 years later, when the Cold War was more set in and or elections were on the line, or if FDR had died before being reelected in 1944, we might have done it. But in 1946, President Truman was desperately trying to de-escalate tensions over the Black Sea and avoid another war. I will talk about the Black Sea crisis and Western fears of Soviet domination over, quote, the whole and the whole Near and Middle East, as Truman worried at the White House in a August 15th briefing. But safe to say, he leveraged his response to the Trieste crisis as a tool in the Black Sea. In reality, the U.S. government was more frustrated by Tito than anything else. He was distracting them from the bigger picture, and more importantly, being deliberately provocative at a time when neither the U.S. nor the USSR had the bandwidth for some third-party asshole trying to start war without their permission. Especially because, in the American point of view, Tito was being completely unreasonable. He was demanding a strict policy of no Allied planes over the Yugoslav occupation zone, which the Allied occupation was perfectly happy to agree with, but in a press conference on August 20th, Acting Secretary of State Dean Acheson, who's his own bizarre can of worms that we do not have time for, had this to say. Any nation has a right, of course, to say that planes of no other nation without its permission shall fly over its territory, and nobody wants to fly over anybody else's territory without permission. But as we have constantly pointed out, in flying, you get lost, particularly on borders.
What a Chad.
And yeah,
Chad,
that's completely true. It's 1946, air navigation was not an exact science, and international borders are very small lines to keep track of from several thousand feet in the air, especially when those borders are brand new. However, the United States had also been deliberately testing those boundaries to trigger this exact response for five goddamn months.
Well, it's like that toxic, you know, the toxic boyfriend. They're going to keep pushing into those boundaries to see.
I'm not touching you.
No, it's like they're pushing the boundaries to see what you can get away with. And then they're like, oh, no, we didn't do anything wrong when you call them out on it.
I'm not gaslighting you. You're just a crazy bitch.
Yeah, that was basically U.S. foreign policy for like 40 years.
I'm not gaslighting you. You're just crazy. You made gaslighting up because you're crazy.
Oh man, it reminds me of that one, the Snappable Jerk on Facebook. Ugh.
What jerk? What guy on Facebook?
Oh, it's a content creator, Snappable Jerk. He's just a guy who acts like a gaslighter and like a horrible person. And it's just him.
It's a character he plays or something?
Yeah, it's a character he plays. He's a really nice guy otherwise, supposedly. He says he's a nice guy.
People who say that are questionable.
What? I'm a nice guy, don't you know?
You have to clarify that you're a nice guy, you know, you probably aren't a nice guy. It should be self-evident.
Well, speaking of nice guys, Tito and Stalin both took a hard line, with Tito declaring that the Americans were only interested in, quote, imperialistic peace, and that Yugoslavia would never accept that peace at any price.
Was he wrong?
Well, there was peace in Yugoslavia while he was there.
He was correct about imperialistic peace. He was incorrect about the price. Stalin demanded that the U.S. apologize for violating Yugoslavia's borders. The American public response was stereotypically rational, with the New York Daily News publishing a column that called for dropping an atomic bomb on, quote, some uninhabited district of Yugoslavia. Yeah, the public was still sort of figuring out how nukes worked and what exactly the Balkans looked like, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of low-hanging fruit to quote from the New York Daily News, but I would like to say that I don't know if it was probably still a tabloid back then. I don't know what happened. But let's be real. The New York Times opinion section is not that different.
No. The New York Times opinion section is a tabloid. To my shock and surprise, they were not owned by Hearst, which I fully expected.
Wasn't it also founded by Alexander Hamilton or something?
I think it's a little younger than that. No, they were founded by Joseph Patterson, apparently.
So James Patterson's ancestor?
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yes.
Is a James Patterson ancestor?
That was his dad.
Oh.
Wait, are you joking?
Well, which James Patterson?
The prolific writer.
The guy who made those Maximum Ride novels that were huge when I was in middle school. Never read them. They looked dumb. And I was probably right.
No, different no. James Patterson. Possibly related.
Oh, that's still funny, though. It's like, oh, yeah, he is related. That's his dad. I'm like, oh, of course, because there's only like five names in American history.
I mean, it's not that weird that an author would be related to a newspaper publisher.
Right. That's all I'm saying. Yeah, I can't find any obvious connection, but also I'm clicking through Wikipedia at a glance, so who knows?
Yeah.
Where the hell was I? Ah, right. New York Daily News wants to nuke some uninhabited area of Yugoslavia because they don't know what Yugoslavia looks like. And in response to the Yugoslav attacks, Dean Acheson dictated the American response to their ambassador in Yugoslavia on August 22nd. Quote, "Your government expresses regret because of what you call an unhappy accident. Your government is aware that it was no accident. A Yugoslav fighter deliberately fired on the United States passenger plane. These outrageous acts were perpetrated by a government that professes to be a friendly nation. The United States government demands that you immediately release the occupants of these planes taken into custody, also that you ensure their safe passage beyond Yugoslavian borders. The United States government also demands that its representatives be permitted to communicate with any occupants of the two planes who are still alive. If within 48 hours of receipt of this note, these demands are complied with, the United States government will determine its course in light of evidence then secured and Yugoslav government's actions to right the wrong done. If, however, within that time, these demands are not complied with, the United States government will call on the United Nations Security Council to meet promptly and take appropriate action." Now, I want to point out, the United Nations Security Council still had the Soviet Union on it with veto power at the time, so appropriate action would still, even in 1946, mean doing fuck all.
Gotta love that veto action from the UN.
Oh, UN Security Council, how should we get out of the kelp forest?
Veto!
Nothing.
Nothing. Nothing. Yeah. No, a useless body. Due entirely to giving the most powerful countries the ability to say no to everything.
Mm-hmm. It's useful for some people.
Well, a bit of a tangent, but Joseph Patterson from the New York Daily News is the grandfather-in-law of Madeleine Albright.
Huh.
Yeah.
I forget who that is. I don't pay attention. I know her name. I just forget what she has done.
I think she's Secretary of State.
I assume she's like some publishing magnate.
She was Secretary of State under Clinton. Yeah.
Okay.
It's okay. We swear we're a democracy with no aristocrats. Anyway, some American aristocrats decided that this demand should be paired with the arrival of further U.S. forces in the region on the same day, in the form of the aircraft carrier USS Franklin Roosevelt, which arrived at Malta, ostensibly to carry out training exercises, but very obviously to everyone involved as a threat to Yugoslavia and the Soviets. The carrier group, including the accompanying battleships, destroyers, etc., you know, board game pieces, took up positions in the Adriatic Sea between Italy and Yugoslavia. And when I say that everyone was aware of this, I mean everyone. In Australia, the Sydney Morning Herald very deliberately published the U.S. ultimatum to Yugoslavia immediately above news coverage of the carrier's arrival and next to an article about the Turkish resistance to Soviet encroachment on the Dardanelles. All of this was enough for Stalin to take his issues to the Security Council, where he was talked down from his aggression toward Turkey, effectively ending both crises through the same set of actions.
I always find these like periods in history so funny where like one person being calmed down is enough to avert disaster.
Yeah, that is the effective part of dictatorships, made ineffective by everything else the dictators do.
Yeah. It's like Hillary Clinton refusing to talk to Bill Clinton after the Monica Lewinsky scandal dropped until she called him, urging him to drop bombs on Serbia, I believe.
Jesus. Those people. My God.
Or, I don't know. I think Antonin Scalia kicked the bucket right after he voted no on important labor rights case in SCOTUS. So I think one commentator said something like, yeah, the rights of a bunch of people to strike was hinged on whether or not Antonin Scalia did some sit-ups that morning.
Good. Yeah. Look, if we get into...
all the reasons Scalia sucks?
When SCOTUS... No, just when any given SCOTUS judge decided to die, we could be here all day, because they all end up screwing somebody over.
True.
But, completely unrelated to anything that might ever come before the Supreme Court or screw somebody over, check out these products and services. Guaranteed by not me to never screw anybody over.
Gamarjoba, my name is Roberto, and I would like to sincerely thank you for taking the time to check out my podcast, The History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. In all likelihood, I would venture to guess that you found us because you were searching for either podcasts, YouTube videos, blogs about the history of Georgia, or you're hearing this on another podcast, like this one. I'm both sorry and happy to report that this beautiful and fascinating country is, to my great surprise, criminally underrated in the history world. As of now, this is the only podcast I am aware of dedicated to the full history of a nation and a people that have served as the battleground for empires all throughout European and Asian history. But the land of the Kartveli is so much more than that. The birthplace of wine, the second Christian kingdom, the land of fantastic food, nearly superhuman dancers and musicians, and perhaps, most importantly, a people that have preserved their culture, pride, and independence after centuries of one conquest after another. Empires rise and fall, but Sakartvelo always seems to survive in the end. So, let us celebrate this beautiful land by coming with me on this journey from prehistory to the present day, right here at the History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. You can find us on Twitter at @history_Georgia. Sakartvelo is spelled Sakartvelo. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
Anyway, the withdrawal of Soviet support forced Tito to negotiate as well, and after meeting with the American ambassador and looking at the sudden influx of American air, land, and sea power surrounding his country, he backed down, agreed to release the hostages, and exhumed the bodies of the airmen who had been killed in the attacks from the mass grave where they had been buried. Told you there was going to be a big hole.
Tell something from the...
He also agreed to pay $150,000 in reparations, which is about $2.3 million in modern money. He followed this up with a statement on August 31st saying, "I have issued orders to our military authorities to the effect that no transport planes must be fired at anyone, even if they might intentionally fly over our territory without proper clearance, but that in such cases they should be invited to land. And if they refuse to do so, their identity should be taken, and the Yugoslav government informed hereof so that any necessary steps could be undertaken through appropriate channels." This was actually an extremely important series of responses from Tito, not just for Trieste, but for the world in general. International flight was still relatively new, and the Trieste crisis set the precedent for dealing with unarmed aircraft incursions under international law. You don't shoot down trespassing planes if they are not a threat. You can force them to land. If you do attack, the attacking party is liable for damages. Of course, this shit still happens, and in a post-9/11 world, you can get away with a lot more on the international stage for anything that has to do with a plane. But by and large, this is still the framework for how these sorts of things are supposed to work. And that was kind of the end of the crisis in Trieste. In January of 1947, the occupied zones of the Venezia Giulia officially became the free territory of Trieste. Elections were held in both occupation zones to establish nominally independent local governments, with communist representatives winning in the south and pro-Allied capitalists winning in the north. Somewhat predictably, as their elections were being carried out under foreign occupation. Those occupations were supposed to end with Trieste reunified as an independent microstate just as soon as a territorial governor could be appointed. However, under the UN declaration that created the free territory, both sides of the occupation and all members of the Security Council had to agree on candidates for governor, and Stalin vetoed every single candidate that came up because they were not exclusively pro-Soviet. This went on for years, with the two occupation zones far outlasting their mandate because Stalin, and Tito to a lesser extent, wouldn't compromise on Trieste. And by then, the Truman Doctrine had become U.S. policy. The Truman Doctrine was an unofficial guiding ethos developed by President Harry Truman and formalized into official U.S. policy with the help of Dean Acheson, that held that the United States could not allow communism to spread, because the further it spread now, the further it would continue to spread later. If you're familiar with the later Cold War, especially in Vietnam, you may recognize this as the utterly shit-for-brains domino theory of Cold War politics, and the Truman Doctrine laid the foundations for that. So the Western Allies weren't about to allow Trieste to go red, because good God, man, what if Italy went red? Then Austria, and France, and West Germany, and Britain, and Spain, and shit-for-brains, I'm telling you.
You know, and you think if they just decided to help the people out a bit more, that you would avoid communism altogether.
Yeah, I don't remember who said it, but there is the excellent quote that FDR gave America a taste of socialism so that they wouldn't rise up and demand all of it. Which is not untrue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that way you're like, give us some things so we don't go all the way, essentially. But nope, because of communism, we lost out on a bunch of nice stuff.
So the failure to uphold Yugoslav dominance in Trieste was a massive embarrassment for Tito. He had made supporting both communism and the Slavic peoples of the Venezia Giulia a cornerstone of his international policy, and Stalin withdrawing support over that kneecapped Tito's ability to demand any further concessions from the Allies. This was not the first time the two communist overlords of Eastern Europe had come to angry disagreements over official policy, but it was the biggest crack to date. During the war, Tito, then leading partisan resistance, had requested help from the Soviet Red Army. You will probably recognize World War II as a point in time when the USSR did not have any extra help to give, and Tito only received token assistance from the communist power to his east. That was compounded by the issue that, since Stalin really needed to be stingy with his supplies, any Soviet assistance came with a bunch of strings attached. Whereas the British and Americans were basically willing to throw military equipment to anybody who pinky promised to use it on Nazis. Which, frankly, is how Stalin was also getting most of his weapons at the time. See the Lend-Lease partnership. So, Yugoslav communist partisans liberated their country from a fascist occupation more or less without the aid of the wider communist bloc. But that didn't stop Stalin from complaining the whole time, especially by saying that Tito and his partisans were using too much communism in their imagery and propaganda.
Huh?
Yes, the Soviet Union thought that Tito was too much of an open communist.
Lol. I mean, is this before or after Stalin tried to assassinate Tito.
Before that, comes right at the end of this episode.
Oh, perfect.
there was actually some validity to this from Stalin's perspective, at least. Everyone knew that once fascism was defeated, communism would be the next big target ideology from the West. And Stalin didn't want Tito's personal fanaticism to compromise Western aid to the Soviet bloc. Tito said, fuck that, the Western powers are the ones giving me guns. Which is also fair.
True.
After the war, the rift continued to widen. There's obviously the issue of Trieste, but on a fundamental level, Tito was a very different sort of communist from Stalin. Titoism, the ideology we've been referencing throughout the episode, was Yugoslavia's signature brand of leftism by rejecting the USSR as the sole font of communist ideology. In fact, the major ideological divide between Tito and Stalin was the idea that communism even needed a single guiding superpower in the first place. Where Stalin saw himself and his country as absolutely necessary to spread communist influence, Tito was adamant that communist countries should not have to bow to the whims of the Soviet Comintern. And since Stalin hadn't done much to help Tito, the Yugoslav dictator was the only significant leader in Eastern Europe that didn't owe his position directly to the Soviets. He was kind of a European Mao, and like Mao and the Chinese communists a decade or so later, Tito began to split away from Stalin's influence. Stalin cut a deal with Churchill not to interfere in Greece, but when Greek communists launched a civil war, Tito supported them despite Soviet protests. Heavily informed by Yugoslavia's origins as the Slavic nation state in Europe following World War I, Tito wanted to form a federal union between Yugoslavia and Bulgaria. Stalin greatly preferred that Bulgaria remain nominally independent as a Soviet client state, in part because it gave their bloc an additional seat in the UN. Over the course of these negotiations in 1947 and 48, the divide between the two powers became more and more official until in June, Tito formally withdrew from the Comintern and split the Soviet bloc. Of course, he was still an adamant communist, but this split allowed him to explore alternative forms of communism, adopting a policy of placing Yugoslavia above all else in his socialist policies.
My favorite version of that is, my favorite version of his idea of communism is all the IMF loans, which are very funny.
Yeah, Yugoslavia was not really wealthy enough to go strike out on its own, but he gave it his best shot.
Well, he was looking for true communism.
Ironically, for someone who came to power by shooting Nazis, he was skirting right along the line between state communism and what you might describe as national socialism.
Where have I heard of that before?
Yeah, it's vaguely familiar from the beginning of this episode.
We prefer the term socialist nationalism, thank you.
Oh, okay. I believe that's a different micro strain of leftist ideology that probably also sucks. Libertarian socialism, the only socialism that I particularly like.
Wait a second.
But I'll accept most of them.
I'm still not over the time I ran into someone on Facebook who was like in the Libertarian Socialist Caucus of the Libertarian Party. And I was like, he was like, no, we can change the Libertarian Party from within.
Wait,
and I'm like,
that exists?
You are delusional. Yes, it exists. I met somebody who was a part of it, and I called him delusional for thinking that he could change the orientation of the Libertarian Party.
It doesn't make sense in the DSA, let alone the Libertarian Party. Good Lord.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Anyway.
Libertarians, man. They can never agree on anything.
Where do people get these from?
Libertarian socialists are like, no, our commune's not going to issue a driver's license.
Oh, boy.
Or tax you.
Yeah. Yeah, libertarian socialism is my preference in the sense that it's just the old-fashioned name for anarchism.
Yeah, basically.
Oh, wow. Okay. I did not know that that was a factor of the American Libertarian Party. That's stupid.
I mean, it's libertarians. What do you expect?
Factor is a kind of a strong name for it. Like, factor implies they have influence or relevance.
That's fair. A position within.
The DSA has some relevance. The Libertarian Party has none.
Oh my.
Well, I don't know. Maybe they won local elections.
They do occasionally. They are the most successful third party. Like,
what's the DSA?
Fern. Democratic Socialists of America.
Oh, okay.
They basically grew out of the like student new left of the 60s when whatever the other one was called that like was derailed by the Weathermen.
No clue.
Oh, Students for a Democratic Society, SDS. Yeah. Basically all the SDS people quit the SDS and then founded the DSA because they feared the SDS was getting too militant with regards to Maoist entryists and the Weathermen.
This is getting over my head, and I understood none of that. I mean, can we just go with the episode?
For meme reference, the Weathermen are the attack and dethrone God people.
Okay, got it. Yeah.
Yes. That named themselves after a Bob Dylan song.
I didn't know that. That checks out. Oh boy.
Yeah. No, that's why they're called the Weathermen or the Weather Underground.
Hi everybody. This is Trevor from the future again. This section of the show devolved a bit into an extended discussion of the anarchist cookbook and some of the recipes contained within. For both legal and practical reasons, I've cut most of that out. And just kind of left in some of the bits that I think sum up that conversation and provide a little bit of the humor that was going on. Major takeaways, don't use the Anarchist Cookbook. It's not a good guide to making explosives. If you do want to make some of the things from it, it's the 21st century. There's better options out there. I just cannot recommend that you do that. So, anyway, moving on to a totally different brand of socialism. Tito...
That's not true socialism.
Tito saw
your kind of socialism sucks. Mine is a better one.
Fuck hell.
Sorry.
No, this is great. episode 2, we're explaining how to make shitty napalm. It's awesome. I didn't even get to Vietnam before we made napalm.
Yeah, exactly. If you get a rocket from the Acme company, it should work fine.
Rocket power!
Well,
that show was awesome.
There we go. There's a transition. Because, speaking of companies, Joseph Broz Tito saw the highly centralized Stalinist bureaucracy as incapable of meeting his people's needs, which was true, and devolved power to local cooperatives and workers' councils who could produce goods and trade internationally, independent of state authority.
Wow.
Ironically, making him both the Mao and the Deng Xiaoping of Eastern Europe.
Now you see why I like him so much.
Instituting workers' cooperatives already makes him more socialist than Lenin.
Yeah, well, he still had the end-all be-all. But speaking of Lenin, actually, can you guess what Stalin identified this political ideology as? What kind of communist Tito...
Ultra-leftism?
Nope.
Kulakism!
No, what kind of communist would Tito have been accused of being by the USSR?
Ultra-leftism.
Oh, a Trotskyite.
Yes, he was a Trotskyist!
Okay, so I was confused because you brought up Lenin, and I know he wrote that polemic against ultra-leftism, so I said, oh, it must be ultra-leftist.
Oh, no. No, just...
calling him a trot.
Just because...
Which I also consider an insult. If you call me a trot, I will kick your ass.
Well, you are a trot.
We're no longer friends.
But no, anyone who doesn't love Stalin but isn't capitalist must be part of the grand international schemes of Leon Trotsky.
Isn't Trotsky dead by this?
Oh yeah. At this point, he'd been dead for 8 years due to an acute case of ice pick to the brain that he caught from Stalin.
Yeah. Mm. Also, the Frida movie is a lie. He never had sex with Frida Kahlo.
Ah.
Unfortunately.
Poor bastard.
It would have been really interesting if that was true, but it's not. That's just a rumor.
No. Eventually, all of this led to Tito becoming a founding member of the Non-Aligned Movement and the movement's first general secretary, pointing out that Tito was a fucking monster. Anti-communist dissidents, mm-hmm. anti-Titoist ideological dissidents, people who annoyed him, and anybody of even vaguely German or Italian ancestry in Yugoslavia was fair game for being disappeared or murdered by the state police. And Tito's word was law for his country just as much as Stalin's was for the USSR. From the last years of World War II onward, Tito carried out an ethnic cleansing of the German and Italian populations of the Balkans that had lived there for centuries. Specifically, a long-standing Germanic population called the Danube Swabians, who were the victims of outright genocide under Tito's 1944 National Decree, which stripped anybody of German origin of their citizenship and civil rights, dispossessed them of property, and provided the framework for mass execution and deportation to Russian gulags, or local gulags.
What is it with these people in 1940s just mass killing each other and being genocidal? Is there lead in the paint or something?
It wasn't just the 19... Yes, there was lead in the paint.
And the gasoline.
It wasn't just the 1940s. Rest assured.
Yeah. Now, genocide will not stop being a factor of Balkan politics. I think I can just put the period there.
I mean, you're not wrong.
These policies also included kidnapping German children to be raised in state homes or fostered by Serbo-Croatian communist families.
Oh, like in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Yes. Which I want to point out, it meets the UN definition of genocide.
Yes, that is.
This also happened with residential schools in the United States.
Yep. Yeah,
and Canada.
Deliberately erasing the culture of an ethnic group by forcing children to assimilate into the dominant nationality is a form of genocide under international law, which had just been established at this point. They had just hung the Nazi high command, and Tito was actively committing genocide against Germanic populations in his country.
Well, weren't the Belgians also dealing with a bunch of the Congo stuff, too?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The hand economy of
the
Belgian Congo.
Wait, that was Congo. In the 40s? I thought that was in the 19th century.
It started in the 19th century. No. They were still down there.
Okay.
Yeah, they were still going on until, like, the 50s.
What? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Basically until Belgium relinquished control of the Congo.
Jesus Christ.
Yep.
Okay, I'm getting flashbacks to severed hand photos that are everywhere if you Google this.
Europe in the early 20th century, great fucking place. But if you want to learn about the potential to visit or talk about other great places, products? This was the best spot I could come up with for this one, and I apologize to everybody.
In his final days, Alexander the Great's generals asked him who should succeed him. Alexander's answer, the strongest. Taken literally, this would see the close of the classical Greek age, an age thousands of years in the making. Join me, Mark Selleck, as I go back to retell the story of ancient Greece in my series Casting Through Ancient Greece. We will cast our way back to its beginnings, all the way through to the spread of its culture throughout the known world, thanks to Alexander and his generals. You can listen and subscribe to the series at www.castingthroughancientgreece.com, or you can listen on your favourite podcasting platform. Don't forget to follow the series over on Twitter at Casting Greece or on Facebook at Casting Through Ancient Greece. I look forward to seeing you there.
However, this is the Cold War, and a little thing like genocide wasn't about to make the United States back away from any advantage they could get over the Soviets. We had Nazi scientists designing our rockets and teaching the nascent CIA how best to interrogate prisoners.
Oh, Assad also did that.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Did you know? Yeah.
Everyone.
Assad also did that.
Uh-huh. And then the CIA came around to teach the improvements they'd made on those techniques.
Yes. So, yeah. Assadist leftists. That, you're wrong.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Who's Assad?
The Syrian dictator.
Who must go? Bashar al-Assad, the dictator of Syria.
Ah, okay.
The eye doctor. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, that was okay. His job before becoming in charge of a country.
Wasn't there something where, like, he and his wife love romantic comedies or something?
Yeah, that was a thing when they were briefly trying to find a way to humanize him at the beginning of the Syrian civil war. I'm sure it's true. Dictators have taste in media just like everyone else.
I mean, Stalin loved Westerns, and who can blame him?
So did Hitler.
Yeah.
Hitler, big fan of American Westerns.
You know, maybe this probably says something about, like, authoritarianism and the appeal to the conquering and the civilization of the West that's depicted in Westerns, but let's not get into it.
Uh-huh. We are nearing the last paragraph of this script.
we'll trudge there eventually.
In 1948, the United States started supplying Yugoslavia with money and military equipment, and even convinced Tito to join a Balkan mutual defense pact with Greece and Turkey, on the condition that he stop funding the communists in Greece's civil war.
But why would you ever do that?
Because he no longer had the USSR giving him guns and money, which are the foundations of international diplomacy.
Makes sense.
This Western cooperation with Yugoslavia eventually led to the 1954 London Memorandum signed by the US, UK, Italy, and Yugoslavia, formally disestablishing the Free Territory of Trieste, which had never really been allowed to exist in the first place, and allowing Italy and Yugoslavia to fully annex their respective occupation zones. Specific disputes over where exactly the border should sit in some parts of the Venezia Giulia continued until 1975, but for the most part, the issue of Trieste ended with the Tito-Stalin split, which effectively shattered any ability to install a functioning permanent government for the free territory. And ironically, the first hot battleground of the Cold War wrapped up because the communist side that had fired the first shots became the United States' first tentative communist ally. And after Stalin's death in 1953, the USSR was more willing to just settle the issue than continue arguing over this little strip of Adriatic coastline. And that is the story of Trieste, the Trieste crisis, and the free territory.
So, I just looked up Trieste on the map, and it finally dawned on me that I know this from playing map games. Specifically, Hearts of Iron 4.
I thought playing map games made you an expert in international relations.
No, not even in actual relations.
Yeah, human relations, certainly not. Talking to women, map games do not help with that.
If I remember correctly, the best way to go about international relations based on games that I've played is to marry your sister to the other country, then marry your own niece to yourself to form an alliance. Or maybe I just pick the Zoroastrian religion in Crusader Kings too often.
I think so, buddy. Except I play typically as, I typically play as Spain, so I get a lot of the same things anyways.
Can you roleplay the Reconquista in?
Yeah.
In
yes. That? Yes.
Ah, what a good thing to roleplay.
I mean, I would say that's fun, but it's not really fun.
It's not really roleplay, but you can pick decisions. I'll let you do the Reconquista.
All right. So we're. We're putting Roberto on record as pro-Reconquista.
I mean, I have Spanish descendancy.
Yeah, you are Cuban. That let's look at how Spain ended up with that one.
I would be happy to talk about Cuba.
Cuba, future friend of the show.
For which event?
All of them. Most of the island's history.
Yeah.
At least post the U.S. But what did you guys think of the first battle of the Cold War?
I thought it was a very interesting look, because this is something that I really don't think about, because it's like, oh yeah, it's just Joseph Broz, you know, doing stuff, and it's like, oh, Trieste, who cares about that tiny island? It's a vacation place.
I found it very entertaining, the detail that America was just deliberately skirting the borders to try and trigger a military response from Yugoslavia is like, it's just very funny, to be honest. It's just a very comical period of history.
So on brand for the U.S. Cold War that it's almost surprising to see it so early.
So what I'm hearing is the U.S. is sending people across the Yugoslavian border. They're not sending the best people either.
Yeah.
They're sending pilots. They're sending Turkish diplomats.
Let me tell you, they're sending pilots. These planes don't even have guns.
Yeah, I will say that the Yugoslav Air Force did choose its targets wisely, and that they waited until it was planes without guns to assert their airspace.
Yeah, that is very smart of them.
Just so Tito can go down, you know, the main square in Belgrade and shoot someone down the street, and no one's going to bat an eye.
But yeah, this event goes on to define Cold War relations in Southeastern Europe, and the history of international air diplomacy.
Well, that's a great way to figure out. Yeah. I didn't know that's how it started. So basically,
the world's deadliest game of I'm not touching you, I'm not touching you.
So basically, air diplomacy started because of Joseph Tito Broz.
That is accurate.
Yeah. We were the good guys and it was their fault. Got it. Okay, cool.
Uh-huh. Yeah, definitely weren't trying to provoke this the entire time. Admittedly, like, all of the incidents where anybody shot at one another were Yugoslavia shooting at Americans.
Or offering alcohol to a Gurkha.
That is such a bizarre story. It's not even super relevant to the episode. I was just like, well, I can't pass this up because...
Oh no, I appreciate those stories so much. I'm like, yeah, then a Gurkha beheaded someone. What? I didn't know Napal had Gurkhas.
We can't pass up the story of the friendliest person in the British army.
Yeah. One of our chaps has beheaded a man. Just picture the look on Norden's face getting that news. Like,
oh, someone just beheaded someone. Bit of a bother, really.
Middle of the night, the bars are closing, sergeant's in bed, and one of his majors comes in and is like, we have a problem.
Sir, we have a problem. What? Oh, it's a bit of a bother, really.
Yeah, that is Trieste. That is our first Cold War episode, which will account for approximately 30% of all episodes of the show, I assume. Do you guys want to plug your stuff?
Brendan, do you want to plug Czar Power and I'll plug Georgia?
Yes. Roberto and I are the hosts of Czar Power. We rank all the Russian rulers from Rurik to Putin to see who gets to party it out in the Kremlin, who gets sent off to the Gulag. We just covered, Yaropolk II, was it?
Yep.
Yeah, we just covered Yaropolk II, and that puts us about the year 10 or 11, something.
1139.
Yeah, the year 1139, where there was some shenanigans regarding, well, I mean, it's pretty much the whole podcast, but there was shenanigans regarding who was going to be in charge of the city of Kiev and or Novgorod, which the first interesting, most interesting thing for a while happened. The city of Novgorod was no longer ruled by the Grand Prince of Kiev. They became independent, so to speak.
Yep. And I run the History of Sakharovilo, Georgia, which is a podcast that looks at the history of the Black Sea Nation of Georgia down in the Caucasus from their prehistory all the way to the modern day. We are returning for season 3 on January 14th. I don't know when this episode is coming out, so this will probably date that. But there's fantastic episodes. We have one, if you're listening to Trevor, you probably heard his History of Persia. There's one on Achaemenid Georgia. And we actually have an episode of Trevor on Zoroastrianism, so you should check those out.
I forgot that I recorded that.
Surprising amount of overlap between the history of the Persian Empire and Georgia, which I suppose, considering, you know, geography...
Their neighbors.
it shouldn't be that surprising, but I was not aware of that history, and it was fun to learn about. Also, fun fact, originally it was going to be the history of Georgia from prehistory to 2008, because Roberto didn't want to get banned from entering Russia by covering the Russo-Georgian War. But that kind of went out the window because of, a little skirmish.
Everything.
in the past. Has it been 2 years or 1 year? I forget. It's been in the past
almost two years.
Yeah. Was it February 2020?
2021.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah. So, little thing happened in the last 2 years, and that kind of went out the window.
Yeah, it'll be three by the time this episode is out. But yeah, post.
If you want to find me on social media, just find me on Twitter. I'm not calling it X; it's Twitter at Foster_writing, or on Blue Sky. At brendanfoster.bluesky.bksy.social. And then you can find links to all my projects there.
You can find Czar Power at basically on anything as Czar Power Pod. Czar spelled TSAR. And Georgia, you can find it as history_Georgia on most social medias. We are revamping the website, so that'll happen eventually once I can pay off the website fees.
Yeah, get off Twitter. Yeah. Go somewhere else. Get offline. I deleted it from my phone, and I'm a happier person for it. But speaking of Twitter, if you want to follow me there, you can do that at History of Persia, or use that same username on other social media platforms, because I don't want to deal with extra Twitter accounts. They make me sad. If you want to follow and get more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com or secretwarspod.com, or technically historyofpersiapodcast.com, because they should theoretically all take you to the same place. And with that, I declare this episode done, just like the Trieste Crisis. In the meantime, there will be another bye week, and my parting advice to you is to not intentionally provoke someone to shoot down your airplane. It seems like a good bet. See ya.
In his final days, Alexander the Great's generals asked him who should succeed him. Alexander's answer, the strongest. Taken literally, this would see the close of the classical Greek age, an age thousands of years in the making. Join me, Mark Selleck, as I go back to retell the story of ancient Greece in my series Casting Through Ancient Greece. We will cast our way back to its beginnings, all the way through to the spread of its culture throughout the known world, thanks to Alexander and his generals. You can listen and subscribe to the series at www.castingthroughancientgreece.com, or you can listen on your favourite podcasting platform. Don't forget to follow the series over on Twitter at Casting Greece, or on Facebook at Casting Through Ancient Greece. I look forward to seeing you there.
Gamarjoba, my name is Roberto, and I would like to sincerely thank you for taking the time to check out my podcast, the history of Saakatvelo, Georgia. In all likelihood, I would venture to guess that you found us because you were searching for either podcasts, YouTube videos, blogs about the history of Georgia, or you're hearing this on another podcast, like this one. I'm both sorry and happy to report that this beautiful and fascinating country is, to my great surprise, criminally underrated in the history world. As of now, this is the only podcast I am aware of dedicated to the full history of a nation and a people that have served as the battleground for empires all throughout European and Asian history. But the land of the Kartveli is so much more than that. The birthplace of wine, the second Christian kingdom, the land of fantastic food, nearly superhuman dancers and musicians, and perhaps, most importantly, a people that have preserved their culture, pride, and independence after centuries of one conquest after another. Empires rise and fall, but Saakatvelo always seems to survive in the end. So, let us celebrate this beautiful land by coming with me on this journey from prehistory to the present day, right here at the History of Saakatvelo, Georgia. You can find us on Twitter at @history_Georgia. Saakatvelo is spelled SAQARTVELO. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast.